This is the 21st, and tomorrow is Juneteenth, a day commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S. We'll talk about the history of Juneteenth and growing calls this year to make it a federal holiday. Then, with parts of life returning to some version of normal, even as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, it's worth considering what we might want to keep from quarantine. Do you have a new hobby or a new habit? Give us a call later this hour. We'd love to hear about it. And we'll hear from people in Central Illinois who have been documenting their experiences during the pandemic over the course of several months for a PBS storytelling series. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is produced by Illinois Public Media and airs on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air this morning, we're following a story out of Washington, D.C., where the U.S. Supreme Court has issued a ruling that means hundreds of thousands of young immigrants cannot be deported, at least for the time being. The court blocked a move by the Trump administration to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program, which provides temporary legal status for immigrants who came or were brought to the U.S. as children. The Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights says there are 42,000 such people in Illinois. Our senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin has been active on the issue and spoke about it this morning in the Capitol. He says tens of thousands of DACA recipients are also healthcare workers.
So if you're a patient at a clinic or a hospital today fighting COVID-19 and your doctor or nurse just walked in the room with a big smile, it's because the Supreme Court said to that healthcare worker, that healthcare hero, you can stay in America. We need you.
We'll continue to follow this story and plan to bring you a full conversation early next week. Tomorrow, though, June 19th, marks 155 years since Union General Granger arrived in Texas to read federal orders to the city of Galveston announcing that all enslaved persons in the state of Texas were free. This Juneteenth, though, falls at a moment in American history when conversations about racism and white supremacy sparked by the killing of George Floyd are at the forefront. We want to know how you will be commemorating Juneteenth and if the protests or national conversations we're having about race now have made this Juneteenth different for you. You can join our conversation today by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. For now, I'd like to welcome our guests. Professor Courtney Joseph Pierre teaches history and African-American studies at Lake Forest College, and Chip Moody is the manager of new media and community partnerships at the DuSable Museum of African-American History in Chicago. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, Professor Joseph, I want to begin with you. Can you tell us about the origins of Juneteenth and why Juneteenth is when it is and the significance of that day?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting to think about the Civil War as and freedom to the enslaved population at that time of African Americans as being a kind of step-to-step process. And so typically often people think of, oh, Emancipation Proclamation, all the slaves are free, right? No, despite Lincoln's proclamation in January 1863, we don't see that, you know, enslaved people are suddenly free because it really couldn't be implemented in the places that were still under Confederate control. And in addition, couldn't be implemented to the Union states that still had slaves, including Delaware, Kentucky, and several others. So we then see the surrender finally, the Civil War is over, 1865, and one would think, okay, now it's over, right? And now all of the enslaved people now are free again.
This is April, right? What Appomattox is April, I think?
Yes, April, yeah. 1865. And so, you know, General Lee surrenders, it seems like it's over, and yet again, it's not quite that, you know, all African Americans are suddenly free, because you have to think about how they're being told the information. And you might imagine that former slave owners don't really want to share that information with the people that they deemed as property. They're not really interested in seeing that freedom happen. So it takes until January 19th, 1865, when about 2,000 Union troops, you know, drive in Galveston Bay, Texas, and they see, you know, people still working, under slave labor. And they then announce, as you mentioned, that famous order number 3 that then says, okay, no, you may not have gotten word, but slavery has been abolished. And so that's where you get the origins of Juneteenth. But even then, it's still not a perfect story to freedom after that.
Sure, of course not. And I mean, we're still seeing the ramifications of that imperfect story to freedom today, I think. Chip, I want to bring you into the conversation. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what Juneteenth means to you.
Well, Juneteenth is I think as a civilian and not one who has always been very well acquainted with history, was something I learned about late in high school and closer to my college years, where having a conversation with my grandparents, where we're talking about things that they knew and getting this intergenerational conversation going, whereas why certain dates are important and what their understanding of freedom was coming from the time period that they came from. So for me, learning about Juneteenth was, one, encouraging, because just personally as an African American, you understand that we have a very specific history. And when we talk about the 4th of July, sort of America's institution, we know that at that genesis, African Americans were not considered to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. And so as we move forward in history from that point, it creates something, at least inside of me, where it really made me question the things that I was seeing, learning, and hearing about. So we talk about freedom. We understand that America culturally, in quotes, is free. But if my ancestors and, you know, my relatives at that time were not free, then what are we really talking about at that point? So Juneteenth is always a moment for reflection for me on the country that we live in, where we've come from, and how much further we have to go.
And Chip, you work at the DuSable Museum in Chicago. Can you talk a little bit about how the museum has commemorated Juneteenth in the past and what's happening this year, given that I presume the pandemic restrictions are still not allowing people to come in the museum, unless I'm mistaken about that?
No, you are correct. Most of Chicago is not open to the public as far as places that have large capacities, if you will. And so we're no different. We're following the protocol and going with the recommendations from the city. But we've been fighting to produce a lot more content in the online space and in the virtual space, where many people have gone now because of the restrictions that have been placed on the city. And so what we have going on this Juneteenth is actually a webcast where we are talking about what reparations are, what an earnest apology to the African American community could look like. And that discussion is happening with a number of judges and some professors from Chicago to really give a perspective on how these things could happen, what they would look like, and the historical significance of that conversation. Because at least as I very generally understand it, the 40 acres and a mule have not been passed out to anyone, at least not that I know.
Mm-hmm. So if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about the origins of Juneteenth and recent calls to make it a federal holiday. We're speaking with Chip Moody, manager of new media and community partnerships at the DuSable Museum in Chicago, and Courtney Pierre-Joseph, a professor of history and African-American studies at Lake Forest College. And Professor Joseph, I want to ask you, a few minutes ago, we heard Chip say that it was pretty late in high school, I think, when he learned about Juneteenth. And this year we're seeing some companies starting to offer a paid day off, and in some places already recognizes it as a state holiday, like Texas, I think, gives state employees time off. I wonder, Professor, do you think we're any closer this year to making Juneteenth a federal holiday? And do you think it should be?
Great questions. I think that what we're seeing right now is some momentum towards recognition for what people have been asking for and talking about for decades into centuries, right? When it comes to acknowledging African-American history as American history, not a side thing that you learn about for 1 month or a side thing that is an addition to a textbook or a paragraph in a textbook, or that it's a state-to-state holiday. It's actually in 47 out of 50 states have it designated as a holiday right now in some capacity. I think we're seeing a push for that potentially to happen. And again, this has been in the works for some time. If you think about representatives in Texas, including Sheila Jackson Lee, who's been introducing resolution to recognize Juneteenth annually. And so potentially because of this moment of reckoning with, I think, that we're at as a country when it comes to race and not just being able to say that it's past anymore, seeing it and seeing more people kind of agree with that, potentially we could see Juneteenth as a national holiday. At the same time, I think it's important for us to think about how difficult it is to get a federal holiday, especially when you're talking about for African Americans. And so it's really important to note that it took Coretta Scott King over 20 years to finally get Martin Luther King Jr. Day as a federal holiday. And that's our only holiday as a nation that commemorates a African American person. We have all sorts of other holidays, which I won't get into now, but it could be that finally have the mobilization and the support to see it through. But we should also consider how long these things are in the works and that they're not instant.
You know, I'm so glad you brought up Martin Luther King Day, because I was wondering about this, and I wonder if you have thoughts on what it says about America. Maybe the correct way to say this is, you know, the white majority who has set the holidays in the past, what it says about our relationship to history, and particularly the history of enslaved African Americans, that, you know, Martin Luther King Day is a holiday, you know, recognized federally, schools closed, banks closed, that sort of thing, and Juneteenth is not. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, this all shows kind of the legacies of enslavement, right? Like, we still very much live as a nation with the unresolved issues around chattel slavery and what they mean. And you can see this in so many different fields, but I think education is one that is really important. You're probably gonna tell my bias here, I'm an educator, so that's why I find it so important, right? But back to Chip's point about not learning about Juneteenth until high school. I have the experience with many of the students who find themselves in a college classroom with me, having that be the first time they've ever heard not only of Juneteenth, but of all sorts of things that have to do with African-American history. And it's not an accident that that happens that way. And so I think it's difficult for all students, no matter their racial background, to suddenly, if at all, learn this real history later in life. And in particular for Black students, how can they be excited about history? How can they have patriotism? How can they really do anything if they don't see themselves reflected in the nation's history that they live in?
And Chip, I wonder, you're in Chicago, which is a city that has for decades now recognized an obscure Polish figure from American history named Kazimierz Pulaski with a holiday, but not, you know, Juneteenth has been, you know, something that's more sort of recently as a city holiday, I think. And it was just debated in the city council this week, as I understand it. I mean, I wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Yes, I do. And you're exactly right. And just to drive home the professor's point a little further, I found out about Juneteenth not at school. It was from conversations with the older generation in my family, which then sparked me to go do some learning on my own, as I was surprised that there would be such a significant date and time in our history that relates to Americans that I would just be completely ignorant about at that time. And you're right. We do celebrate Pulaski Day in Chicago. And I think that the culture of Chicago is growing. And so we are now starting to learn more about more of history and more people who are engaged in the historic narrative. And so now people like Jean-Baptiste Pointe-du-Sable are coming into the conversation as we learn about people who existed outside of, we'll just say, the general historic narrative.
Yeah, and DuSable, of course, an early settler who was, you know, showed that Chicago was a multicultural, multiracial city even before it was a city. Professor
right.
Joseph, yeah, Professor Joseph, we have just less than a minute.
Haitian descent, I always have to say it for my Haitian pride, and a man of Haitian descent, so it's important to think about that too.
Thank you for mentioning that. We unfortunately only have about 30 seconds left, and Professor Joseph, I just want to end with you just briefly. You know, this Juneteenth falls when we're having these, you know, conversations about racism, white people reflecting on their privilege. I wonder if it feels different this year to you because of the moment we're in.
I would definitely say so. I was commenting to a friend of mine that I would never have imagined even 6 months ago that I would be getting corporate emails with a banner that says Black Lives Matter on it. And so that is wonderful and that is progress. But I think what we all need to remember is that we have these moments of progress and they don't lead to real, tangible, sustained change for Black people's lives on the ground level. And so while it's wonderful, and I hope we do get a holiday to celebrate Juneteenth, it's also important for us to then use that time to say, well, how can we give the descendants of these people the full rights that they've been asking for since Juneteenth, the first one?
Professor Courtney Pierre Joseph teaches history and African American studies at Lake Forest College. We've also been speaking with Chip Moody, manager of new media and community partnerships at the DuSable Museum in Chicago. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the country and our state of Illinois gradually reopens in phases, many people are beginning to sense a gradual return to normal, or at least some version of normal. And while the pandemic is far from over, we already know it's undoubtedly changed us. Life in quarantine has, of course, been challenging in many ways, but it's also forced us to reevaluate some of those so-called normal parts of life, at least from the before times. And somewhere in all that social distancing and quarantining are some silver linings. Maybe it's a new realization or a new habit or just having the chance to spend some more quality time with family. So much quality time with family. So maybe, after all, there are actually some parts of life in quarantine that are worth holding on to. Joining us now to talk about COVID-19 silver linings in a recent article on Vox, "The Coronavirus Has Changed Us, and It's Not All Bad," is Segal Samuel, staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. Hello, Segal. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, our lines are open. We're taking your calls on the silver linings of quarantine. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We want to know if any positive realizations, lessons, or habits you might have discovered during social distancing, maybe a new hobby, more time with your kids. Call us and share. 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. So, Segal, you asked Vox's readers to share the specific changes they want to maintain from quarantine. How did you go about that, and what was the response?
Well, I started by putting out a call out on social media and through our email newsletter, asking readers to tell me which changes they want to maintain when they emerge from quarantine. And I got more than 100 responses from across the globe. And right away, I started to see 8 broad trends leaping out in the responses. So I can walk through those for you if you like.
Yeah, maybe pick a couple of to sort of start. What was the most popular sort of trend that you saw in the responses?
So by far the most popular response was reducing consumerism, which I thought was really interesting. A lot of people said they want to spend less money shopping for new gadgets and new clothes. They're realizing that a lot of their previous consumer behavior was about instant gratification, but it wasn't necessarily bringing lasting happiness. So lots of people told me they want to just mend and make do going forward. And to the extent that they do have to buy new things, people want to spend their money on small local businesses. So that's kind of an encouraging response.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because a lot of small businesses have obviously suffered during the pandemic, and major corporations, at least the ones with big online presences like Amazon or I guess Walmart and Target that have been able to stay open in most places, they've thrived. Can you talk a little bit more about what people have said about, you know, shopping local?
Yeah, I mean, one 23-year-old illustrator in the United Arab Emirates actually wrote in and she said, "It breaks my heart how much these small local businesses have suffered lately and how, unlike big corporations, they're less likely to survive." So I think there really is this growing awareness that, you know, there's utility to putting your dollars towards local businesses because we've seen with our own eyes how vulnerable they are when something like a pandemic hits.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with our guest, Sigal Samuel, staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect, where she recently wrote a piece called "The Coronavirus Has Changed Us and It's Not All Bad." And we want to hear how it's changed you in good ways. If you have any silver linings from the pandemic, positive realizations, that sort of thing, give us a call, 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. And we've been talking among our staff about, for parents of children, maybe who are not used to having kids at home to teach and feed and entertain all day long. And sometimes they themselves are working, the parents are. And I want to read a response we got from our Text the 21st group. This one is from Angie in Onarga, Illinois, who says, quote, "A couple of weeks into my kids being home from school, I was trying to understand how the quarantine was affecting them. I suddenly realized the amazing number of people who would love on my kids every day at school." And then I'm going to paraphrase. She goes on to talk about, you know, the good morning from the bus driver, high five from the principal, the PE teacher who gives them reassurance, the favorite lunch lady who gives them a hug. You know, there's a village of people who invest in her kids throughout a school day, she says. And that's Angie from Onarga. So, Sigal, I'm curious what sort of things you heard from parents in your survey.
It was a kind of a funny mix. I think we have to be really honest about the fact that, you know, I'm not a parent myself, but I know that for a lot of parents, this has been a really, really hard time. It's not easy to suddenly have your kids home all the time with you and have to entertain them and educate them. So it has been really challenging. At the same time, a lot of people wrote in saying that the pandemic has taught them they want to prioritize time with family and friends more going forward. Because, you know, when the chips are down, you see who really shows up for you. And for a lot of people, that's their family members. And people have said that this really nice kind of unexpected side effect of the pandemic has happened, where suddenly they found themselves on Zoom or FaceTime calls with estranged family members who are halfway around the world that they didn't get to talk to before. One woman actually said that, you know, she's talked more with her nephews in the last few weeks than she's talked with them in years. So there's been some kind of positive outcomes for some folks.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about, obviously the pandemic has not been, we're talking about silver linings, but this is a terrible situation for some people. Unemployment's at record levels, 13.3%. That number hasn't been seen since the Great Depression. And I wonder how that, in your reporting, affected people's experience in quarantine and their ideas of career paths.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned this because I think undoubtedly, the people who are now getting to say, oh, wow, there are some great silver linings here, that is a very privileged position, right? So
totally.
If you've lost your job, for example, you might be really wanting to work more, not less right now. That caveat said, for people who are lucky enough to still have their jobs and to be able to work from home, there is actually a lot of many responses I got saying, we're realizing that we want to slow down and put less career pressure on ourselves. People who have found that a lot of status chasing was actually making them miserable. And quarantine is the first time they've let themselves slow down in many, many years. So it's kind of interesting that people are realizing that all of this sort of hyper-competitive attitude toward work wasn't making them happy, and they're really reevaluating that now.
Interesting. Slowing down at work. Yeah. So, you know, you also write that one of the more encouraging other responses you receive was, you know, now that I guess it's somewhat ironic in a time of social distancing, but the pandemic actually showed people just how interconnected we are, right? And it sparked this greater degree of ethical action and activism. Can you talk about how people are participating now in maybe ways they hadn't prior to the pandemic?
Yeah, so people told me they're donating more to charitable causes, you know, whether it's food banks in the U.S. or, you know, trying to prevent COVID-19 abroad. They're trying harder to reduce their carbon footprint. A lot of people told me they're happy they don't have to commute to work offices anymore because it's saving, it's helping to save the environment a bit. And they're engaging in more political activism. I think we've seen very clearly that this pandemic is disproportionately taking Black lives, and the protests we've seen in the past few weeks around mobilizing for Black lives have galvanized a lot of people. I think millions are now fighting for racial justice who weren't doing that before. I think that's partly a result of the killing of George Floyd and the protests around that, but also partly around this realization that COVID has taken a harder, a more serious toll on Black communities. So it's kind of, it's been encouraging to see that extra mobilization in terms of political activism.
You know, on that subject of public engagement with news and politics, I want to read one of the responses you received that intrigued us. It's a quote, "For the longest time, I did not keep up with current news. It's not hard to see why. Our world is a mess," and I'm substituting for a more colorful metaphor there, "but our world is a mess and my mental health is bad enough as it is." This was from Adrian DeRoy, a 27-year-old reader in the U.S. Goes on to say, "But the Black community is rising up yet again to face their challenges, made me look, and seeing the world slowly but surely start to fall in step with the protests here, the voices crying out is one. It gives me some small semblance of hope, hope that maybe we will get through this and come out better than we were before." So, Gal, my question to you is, do you think the protests against police brutality and racial injustice would have swept the country to the degree they have if we had not been in this time of pandemic and lockdown or quarantine?
No, I don't. I think that the mass mobilization has been helped by the fact that a lot of people don't have to go into a job, an office every day now. So they're just simply more bodies available to protest in the streets these days. You know, I do think that people would have mobilized regardless, you know, even if we weren't in this weird pandemic time. But I think the availability of bodies, sheerly because a lot of people are unemployed or able to work from home now and have more discretion over their time, has been a helpful force in some sense for these protests.
Listeners, we are talking about quarantine silver linings with our guest Sigal Samuel, staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. And if you want to share your quarantine silver lining, you can give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You may also have heard a few of the responses we've gotten in our Text the 21st group. We also want to invite you to join us there by texting TALK. The number for that is 217-803-0730. That's text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. So, Gal, I'm curious how people have changed the way they're being physically active during the pandemic. We got another text message from Wilbur in Rantoul, Illinois, who says, "Because our parks did not shut down, disc golf has gained more players in the last few months." So there's a little silver lining from Wilbur. I wonder, what did you find that people are doing differently with exercise and physical activity?
Disc golf, that's a new one to me.
Oh, you should try it. It's like a frisbee. You take a frisbee and throw it at a little metal basket.
Wow. Okay. I'm down. Yeah. A lot of people wrote in saying daily exercise. They've kind of discovered the incredible impact this can have on their mental health, their physical health, their sleep, their mood. So a lot of people who weren't previously into fitness have now been getting into running, yoga, other activities to sort of cope with the lockdown. And they say they really want to keep that up after lockdowns are over. I can vouch for that myself. I've been doing a lot of yoga on YouTube, and I'm not the only one. There's this channel, Yoga with Adrian, that has gone insanely popular over the course of the lockdown because a lot of people really want to exercise, but they're stuck at home.
So there's a, I guess, a positive economic story. If you're a YouTuber with a yoga channel, this is a real opportunity for you. You also write that the, just speaking of health, maybe going the other way, that the sourdough obsession is real. And I wonder how the pandemic has changed our relationship with food.
Yeah, it's been actually really funny. A lot of people have been talking to me in very glowing terms about their sourdough starters or the things that they're fermenting. People who are fermenting foods just talk about it with this manic gleam in their eyes. So people are getting really, really excited about it. And I myself, I have never been one to grow herbs, but suddenly I have some cilantro sprouts growing right here in my bedroom. So I think there's a couple things happening with that. I think part of it is this, you know, back to nature impulse. It offers a psychological comfort at a time of major uncertainty for us. And that's not new. We saw that in World War I and World War II, when Americans were growing their own fruits and vegetables in so-called victory gardens. So it's comforting to kind of re-engage with nature and natural ingredients in that way. And I think it's also very practical. I think a lot of us at the beginning of the pandemic were freaking out about whether there would be food shortages and supply chain problems. And so there's this sort of comfort in feeling like, well, if the stores run out of food, at least we'll have these vegetables that we're growing.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder, you know, if that also relates to our relationship with time. And we've even talked on the show about how, you know, pandemic time is sort of this flat circle, to borrow a phrase. You know, I've looked out the same window where I've been hosting this show from in my home in Central Illinois. And, you know, I saw snowfall at one point, and now there's birds and trees and grass. Do you think that this is a, you know, this engagement with nature, this engagement with sort of slow foods has to do with our distorted nature, you know, understanding of how time is affecting us?
I do. I think that actually there's something kind of oddly therapeutic about, in particular, seeing plants and herbs grow. You know, my grandmother, for example, hasn't been able to leave her house since the pandemic really started in March here in North America. And for her, I think the way she's measuring the passing of time is seeing her plants grow day by day. That is the marker that, in fact, time is not a flat circle. It is still moving forward. So there's something kind of comforting in that.
All right. So the last thing I want to ask you about, we've got just a couple of minutes left here, but, you know, for a lot of us, as I was just kind of alluding to, personally, the concept of a workplace has changed in industries, at least where it was possible to work remotely, like public radio host, and people have had to adapt to that. I wonder if you find people have preferred this new virtual workplace. Do you think it's here to stay to some degree?
I do. I think that this has pretty well destroyed the myth that remote work isn't as practical as a 9-to-5 office job. And a lot of people are discovering now that, hey, working from home actually offers a lot of benefits. You know, you have less stress commuting, you can get in some more sleep, you don't have to add pollution when you're commuting. You can work with clients that are in different cities from you. You're not limited by your geography anymore if you're doing all your consultations by Zoom. And I think employers are going to have an increasingly hard time arguing with their employees that, no, you really need to be in the office to be able to do your job. So I do think it's here to stay for, you know, to a certain degree.
All right. Sigal Samuel is a staff writer at Future Perfect, which is part of Vox. Her article is "The Coronavirus Has Changed Us, and It's Not All Bad." We'll have a link to it on our website, which is 21stshow.org. We'll also tweet it out at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Sigal, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st and sharing your reporting.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Coming up after a short break, we are going to be talking about a new documentary effort from PBS. It's collecting stories from people in the pandemic. It's called American Portraits. There's a national initiative, but Illinois Public Media has been talking to people right here in Central Illinois. We're going to be talking to a couple of the participants and about the process of making the documentary. That conversation coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're into documentaries, you're probably familiar with PBS. Frontline, American Experience, and Ken Burns may come to mind. Now public television is trying out a new way of documenting American life, one that's particularly apt during this pandemic and more recently protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd. They're having viewers submit their own video using the technology found in their pockets, their phones. The initiative is called American Portrait. And Illinois Public Media, the PBS station in Urbana, is producing its own version of the American Portrait storytelling series as told through the lens of six people in central Illinois who've been documenting their lives each week since late February. The documentary, again, is called American Portrait, Central Illinois, Living Through the COVID-19 Pandemic. It premieres tonight, Thursday, as we're going to air. Joining us now is Keith Sutherland. She graduated this spring from Central High School in Champaign and documented her experience for American Portrait, Central Illinois. Kia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
Also joining us is Reverend Leah Roberts Mazur from Community United Church of Christ, a progressive Christian church in Champaign. Reverend Mazur, Reverend Roberts Mazur, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. And Kia, congratulations on your graduation.
Thank you so much.
And also with us is Sarah Edwards. She's a senior producer at Illinois Public Media. She produced and edited American Portrait Central Illinois. Sarah, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Sarah, in just a bit, we'll play a clip here of all the voices in this documentary. But let's start by having you tell us just a bit about how these people in Central Illinois went about documenting their lives.
Well, this project was really a first for WILL and for me as a filmmaker, in that it was documented entirely on iPhone, Android, and for the interviews that you see in the documentary on Zoom, because we were not allowed to take cameras to anybody. It was, you know, at the very start of the pandemic. So it was, you know, it was a new experience. I had, you know, I sat back and had everybody just submit the videos to me, and I dealt with the weird audio that came in and sometimes shaky visuals, although there really was not a whole lot of that because these guys were very, very good and very savvy at shooting their own videos.
What was the timeline like? When did they start recording, and when were their most recent videos recorded?
I think the first video came in at the end of March. And the last videos came in just last week as I was in the editing bay finishing up the show. So it was very last minute. And in fact, you know, the protests occurred right as I started the edit. So it was a very last minute it ended up at very last minute project. So
sure. Well, let's play a clip here with some of the voices from the documentary American Portrait Central Illinois Living Through the COVID-19 Pandemic.
Family life was normal. Work was normal.
We started talking about what is this virus thing that's happening in Seattle, and is that going to affect us?
And then kawam, it exploded.
Okay, hi.
It's 7:29.
There was a lot of fear of, you know, hey, are we going to get this disease?
I don't want to get this virus and have it all end.
I had no idea that everything was going to stay closed.
Here's my chef coat.
If the general population is also in fear, then you as an immigrant community then also fear.
It's not all, hey, let's all be hopeful and we can get through this together. There's also a lot of anger.
It's really hard as a parent to say, okay, according to those guidelines, yes, you still can play with your friends, but that's not what we're going to do.
All this equipment is idle.
I'm basically stuck inside my room. How did a 17-year-old in high school, a senior specifically, in 2020 have to like deal with this entire thing?
So Sarah, we have Kia, the high school senior, and Reverend Roberts Mazur with us. We'll hear from them soon. But can you tell us about some of the other four voices who participated and what their experience was like over recent months? You speak with a restaurant owner and a nurse?
Yes. Angie Ruley is a restaurant owner who was set to open her restaurant called Bluefish in Elliott the very week that the pandemic really shut everything down. And she was a wonderful character because she really provides the roller coaster of emotions. I mean, she I don't think she ever expected this to be so long lasting. And so it's an emotional story that really unfolds with her over three and a half months. Marley Corrado is the manager for El Progreso supermarket. And she is a fascinating character because she is on the front lines of dealing with the COVID's impact on the food supply chain. She went through a rough time keeping her stock up and really took the lead in getting the word out to the immigrant community about what was happening and the constantly changing rules. Ronald Baker was the nurse that you mentioned. He's a nurse anesthetist at Carle Hospital, but he found himself really home more as a stay-at-home father dealing with being an educator, too, to his three young sons. So we really get the perspective of what all of us parents have gone through over 3.5 months with our kids, trying to find sanity and our own workspace. And finally, there's Cliff Mansfield, who is an oil producer in Taylorville, who gives us an impact of the virus on, farming and oil industry. So mm-hmm. really important voices there.
Yeah, and you mentioned Marley Corrado, I think the name was the grocer. We spoke with her on the 21st about her role in getting the word out to her community. You can find that on our website, 21stshow.org. Kia, I want to bring you into this conversation. You recently graduated from Central High School in Champaign, and I think you recorded your first video back in March, late March, early April. I wonder if you can talk about what was on your mind back then and if you thought you would, you know, walk across the stage at a traditional graduation at that point.
Yeah, of course. So back then, like when I was recording my first video, I really didn't expect everything to kind of get all extreme. So like at the time, like it didn't really faze me. I was like, okay, I'm going to be out of school for like a month and a half. But I didn't really think it would go really all the way until now, June. I did think for a while that I would walk the stage just because, like I said, I didn't think for this entire thing to really blow up the way it did and escalate. It wasn't until about, I think it kind of like hit me about last minute in May, about like around the time of my graduation, or at least a few weeks, because that's when I was getting like more emails from the school about like other, like just other businesses that I subscribed to talking about like, you know, the virus and how mm-hmm. everything's shutting down. And like some places, some businesses, like they just want to let their customers know, it's like, hey, like we're not opening back up, like stay tight, we're still here, or like, you know, we're still open. And then for the school, it was more like, we're still monitoring this virus to see like how it's going to evolve, I guess.
Yeah.
And then to like keep giving us updates. And then around a few weeks before our graduation, I kind of got the email saying it was going to be postponed until July. And that's when it really hit me. I was like, I'm not going to walk the stage. And that's when the actual emotions of like sadness that I haven't been at school the past few months, or haven't been able to see any of my friends really, that's when that hit me.
So I want to bring Reverend Leah Roberts-Mosier into the conversation. You're a pastor at Community United Church of Christ in Urbana. And I wanted to ask you what was going through your mind when you, as I understand, you started recording during Holy Week. What were your thoughts and expectations about what we were going through at that time?
Pastors often refer to Holy Week as Holy Hell Week. And so it was just, the volume got turned up on absolutely everything. I have colleagues who are out in Seattle. So I was aware that those folks were having to do remote worship and remote programming and, right, because churches do more than just worship. I was aware that that was happening for weeks before we ever received word from public health that we were going to need to shift to remote worship and remote programming. However, we had made the choice to try to have a few folks spaced out in the sanctuary doing a live broadcast from there. And our last broadcast like that was on Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday, when I got home after having led worship in a mask, in the sanctuary, standing 6 feet away from musicians, and I felt awful. I ended up spending that whole afternoon on the phone with church leaders and staff people and colleagues trying to figure out what we needed to do. And then we shifted to being at home and having a whole team of people spread out all over Champaign and Urbana, but now actually spread out across the country because our college students have gone home. And worship happens with this team of people operating on Zoom and then pushing a live broadcast to Facebook. This is not something we covered in seminary at all.
Sure.
Not at all. If
you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about American Portrait, a new storytelling initiative from PBS that asks Americans to send in video to create short documentaries weaving people's stories together. We're speaking with some of the people in Central Illinois who participated by documenting their experience in recent months. And speaking of documenting life, Kia, I want to ask you, there's a moment where you record yourself in one of these video diaries talking about what a moment in history you're living through.
I just kind of thought about it. I kind of always think of the big picture, and especially with how this pandemic is spreading globally, is like definitely going to be something for the history books, like no doubt. And I was like, kids are going to like learn one day about, you know, 2020 and the coronavirus and kind of how it affected everyone. And, you know, maybe seniors in the future at that time will read about how seniors in 2020, how anything so like your day could be simple one moment, but later the next day it can just be all chaotic.
Yeah.
So that's what a lot of like history is really, is like nobody expected things to happen or like things to escalate. And this is definitely one of those instances.
Let's listen to a clip from the documentary that addresses that very point.
Sometimes I'll like just stop doing whatever I'll do in the day and just be like, this is history. And like, I'm a part of it. How did a 17-year-old in high school, a senior specifically, in 2020 have to like deal with this entire thing? And it just, I can't wrap my head around it.
Every 500 years, there's some kind of massive shift, like a seismic shift in the way the world works. And my God, we are living through one of those right now.
Reverend Roberts Moser, you mentioned that this was a seismic shift we're living through. I wonder how you felt being able to document your experience during this time.
The work that I do is often sort of a mystery to people and very misunderstood in the public. You know, people meet me and they say, oh, you're a pastor. Do you pray all day? So it was, I really welcomed the opportunity to be able to document just this little chunk of my home life and my work life for folks to be able to demystify the work of clergy, but also to do it during this moment when churches had to make, well, we all had to make quick decisions on how to shift to be able to keep people safe and alive. Our church, we run a weekly feeding program called Jubilee Cafe. We also have the United Church of Christ campus ministry that nests in our building and we work really closely with that organization. So it wasn't just how do we do church and church life from home, but also how do we keep feeding hungry people when we can't have them in the building? How do we keep our volunteers safe? And then also how do we help campus ministry to think about and to shift their programming to be able to be done in this way, in this moment? It's a lot to think about.
Yeah. And I'm afraid we are pretty much out of time, but Sarah, just really briefly, in about 15 seconds, if people want to see the documentary, where can they watch it, either over the air or online?
You can watch it tonight at 7:30 Central on WILL TV. You can watch it Friday morning at 2:30 a.m. if you like that time slot. And finally, at Sunday, this coming Sunday at 4:30 p.m.
All right. That is Sarah Edwards, who's a producer of the American Portrait for Illinois Public Media. We also spoke with Reverend Leah Roberts Moser, Reverend at the United Community Community United Church of Christ in Champaign, and Kia Southerland, class of 2020 senior in Champaign at Central High School. And that is all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpison's our engagement producer. Our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. I'm Brian Mackey, and The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.